We're joined now by Eric Brenstrom for World Weather. Kia ora, Eric.
Kia ora, Susanna.
You're in the Wellington studio, which is always wonderful to have guests in the evening. Thank you.
No worries.
Now, you've managed to catch up on some of this late sunshine, have you? Well, Wellington didn't really have it when I left there this morning, I have to say.
No, Wellington did not. I've been wearing my winter thermals the last 2 days, but tomorrow's meant to be much better.
Well, that's always good when it turns around. Now, what's been happening in the world with the weather, Eric?
Well, quite a few things. And one of the things that caught my attention was Tropical Cyclone Freddy, which formed just to the northwest of Australia and then made a long journey over the Indian Ocean before hitting Madagascar. Travelling over the land there, it weakened below tropical cyclone strength. It had got up to Category 5 when it was over the Indian Ocean, which is a mean speed of 270 kilometres an hour, so serious, serious animal. But once it crossed over the land of Madagascar, it got over warm water between the Madagascar and Mozambique, re-intensified to a tropical cyclone, made landfall in Mozambique, paused, turned round, went back over the sea, re-intensified, crossed Madagascar and weakened again, and then went back over the sea and hit Mozambique again. So it's potentially the longest-lived tropical cyclone on record. It's going to be investigated to try and work out what length of time it dropped below category cyclone when it was over the land masses. But it has already got the record for the most accumulated cyclone energy, which is a thing where they look at how big it is and what the wind speed is over different parts of it. So a record breaker, and tragically killed quite a lot of people with the flooding, 676 in Malawi and I think 176 in Mozambique were the worst hit. Both those places were already dealing with a cholera outbreak, so they're very worried that that will be intensified. And there are also 17 people died in Madagascar and a few more in Zimbabwe and in Mauritius. And there's a ship missing that was north of Mauritius, a Taiwanese registered ship with 16 crew. So there's still some people unaccounted for. So that was probably the biggest thing that happened. But every corner of the world's got something going on.
It has, but let's just stay on Tropical Cyclone Freddy for a moment if we can. These multiple cycles of rapid intensification, how do you prepare for that?
Well, that's a good question. Not very easily, perhaps. This was something that was little appreciated if you went back 30 years or so, but it's only with the more exact monitoring by satellites that we've been picking up some of these things. And this particular cyclone did, I think, 7 cycles of what they call rapid intensification, where it went up by 35 miles per hour in 24 hours. And I think the previous record holder was only 3 or 4 rapid intensifications. So to some extent, this is because of the fact that the sea surface temperature has been getting a lot warmer in many parts of the world where these tropical cyclones form. And the warm ocean is able to put terrific a burst of energy into a tropical cyclone, partly because it's touching warm ocean, but mostly because you get a lot more evaporation of water. And once that water gas is in the air, it cools down as it rises and then condenses back to liquid, at which point it releases the huge amount of heat that was needed to change it from liquid to gas in the first place. And that's really the secret of how tropical cyclones operate.
And I'm just going to apologise in advance for being such a layperson on this topic, but how much of these cycles can actually be forecast?
This is still a bit of a challenge for the computers, because weather forecasting in the time of my career has sort of shifted to be quite a lot based on computer forecasts, because computers have gotten incredibly good at doing all the maths and physics to tell you what the weather map's going to look like tomorrow. But these rapid intensifications, because they're happening over a fairly small area near the centre of the cyclone, are still a bit of a challenge for the computers, and they're not always well forecast. So it's a case of monitoring with satellites what's actually happening and then updating warnings as they come along. But tropical cyclones basically are not to be trusted. They're to be treated with enormous caution.
Exactly. Okay, where are we going to next, Eric?
Well, I was also taken by the fact that there's been a lot of heavy rain in Peru. There are places on the coast there, like the capital city Lima, they only average 10 millimetres a year, and most of that's from drizzle. So they're essentially deserts. But every now and again it rains heavily. Because it's so dry most of the time, a lot of the towns don't have proper drainage, so they're terribly prone to flooding. And you get all these photos where the walls of the houses kind of join together, so the street's like a little canyon, and you have a river just hurtling down there, picking up any cars that are in the way. The Peruvian Met Service named a cyclone out to sea, Cyclone Yaku, which is actually the Quechua word for water. But it was a confusing thing because they said that it was a badly organised cyclone, which tends to make me think it wasn't a tropical cyclone at all, because they generally don't get them there. But one of the things about this sort of rain is it's often a sign that you're developing what we call an El Niño, and they have the sea surface temperature 2 to 3 degrees above average there, so that it could be a sign that, you know, the rest of the Pacific, as the year goes on, will eventually come under the influence of an El Niño, which is the opposite of what we had in New Zealand in the last summer. But this part of Peru is very prone to landslides, so that's one of the other dangers they've got. And in the town of Quiruvilca, a population of some 1,300, they talk about the town having been pretty much destroyed by landslides. So I think a lot of people got out of the way. The official death toll is only 8, but there's some confusion. Some reports I've come across talk about 50 having died, so the information's a bit confusing there. But you know, the river overflowed its banks in Piura and in Lambayeque. So it's a dramatic event. They get them now and again, and usually these happen during El Niño, and most years they don't get them at all.
Goodness. And what's happening with the sea there?
Well, the ocean is several degrees, maybe 3 degrees above average. Now, this is part of the recipe of how you get El Niño, and that's the warm water that sits on top of the ocean is often very shallow over by the coast of South America, perhaps only 50 metres deep. And by comparison, over at the western end of the Pacific around Australia, it's 250 metres deep. So normally when the offshore winds push the surface water away, you get upwelling of very cold water from underneath. And that's why normally there's very little rain and it's a desert and they get fog and mist. But during El Niño, the warm water gets deeper next to the coast of Peru and Ecuador, so that when the winds are blowing offshore and pushing the surface water away, it's being replaced by warm water from underneath instead of cold. So you get this dramatic change in temperature, which causes rain there. And what tends to happen is that warmer ocean surface phenomena gradually works its way across the Pacific towards Australia, and the end result is we get a summer where you tend to get more southwest winds than average. In comparison, our last summer we had more northeast winds than average. So it could be a sign of things to come. But the other thing that it does, it lifts the global average temperature quite significantly, because the area of the tropical Pacific that is above average is very, very large once you've got a fully developed El Niño. So that is why I think the British Met Service has said there's a 50% chance that next year will be breaking the barrier of 1.5 degrees centigrade of global warming, albeit temporarily and then dropping back below for a while. This year could well be the hottest on record, but then it'll be shattered by next year. So it's disturbing stuff.
It's grim. And then meanwhile, in Greenland, there is a heat wave.
Yes, and of course, people think of Greenland in terms of a huge ice sheet. Well, the capital city, which I think is pronounced Nuuk, N-U-U-K, they got 15.2 degrees centigrade on the 5th of March. So that shattered the previous record for March, which was 13.2 degrees. It also beat the record for the highest temperature ever seen in April, which should be a warmer month. So it's disturbing. It hasn't quite caused the ice to start melting on top of the ice sheet just yet, but they worry that it'll be a sign of what's to come in the Northern Hemisphere summer. Last year was a year with a lot of melting, and they're worried there's going to be more. I think Greenland has now overtaken the expansion of seawater caused by warming. Greenland melt has now overtaken as the biggest cause of our current sea level rise. So again, reason to be concerned. But on a lighter note, there was a thing I saw in Ottawa, not so far away. They've got the largest skating area in the world, big canal. And this last winter they just finished, it was never able to open for the first time. They never got hard enough ice. It had some ice on it, but it wasn't strong enough to hold up the weight of skaters. So a lot of warmth there, in contrast to the fact that back over in California they've been getting snow. So it's the sort of phenomena you do see more and more in the last few decades, that when one part of America, like California, is very cold with snow, you go about 30, 40 degrees of longitude around the world, and that area is getting much warmer than average. Witness the heat in Greenland.
So without further ado, let's go to Spain.
Well, what caught my attention there was that they've been having a wildfire near Valencia. Not huge, but it destroyed about 30 square kilometres of land, or forest, causing a lot of people, over 1,000 people, had to get out of their homes, and you know, they had planes and helicopters and 500 firefighters working on it. But it's very early in the season. As far as they're concerned, they've barely finished with winter. And how come there's wildfires? So what they worried about was that they had their worst year on record last year. I think Spain had 493 wildfires, destroying over 3,000 square kilometres of grass and forest. And they think if we're getting wildfires now at the very end of winter, maybe this is going to be an even worse summer than last year. And what happens in Spain is also witness to the sort of things that you can get in the south of France and Italy and right across the Mediterranean, through the Balkans, even as far as Turkey. So we've been seeing more and more wildfires in that part of the world over recent decades, with droughts and warmer temperatures. And even last year, we had wildfires in London with record heat in England. So the signs are there to see that global warming is taking a bite.
And, of course, there's often those summer winds too, aren't they, that can blow quite strongly?
Yes, they can. It varies from place to place. But if you get the wind crossing a mountain range, then it can be very dry, like we get in Christchurch with a northwester. So there's a number of places in Europe where the winds can cross mountain ranges and really drive these fires.
Let's go to the US and what's been happening in Mississippi.
Well, some very dangerous tornadoes. A place called Rolling Fork, a town of about not quite 2,000. Rolling Fork was pretty much obliterated. If anyone saw the TV photos, it was as if every building had been destroyed. Though I think there were a lot of, you know, those mobile homes and other homes that are not very soundly constructed. The death toll there was 26. I did see a thing on TV where there were a couple of people who hid in a bath, and the bath got lifted up and then turned over, I think, and they got dropped on the ground about where the bath came from, unhurt. One of them was an off-duty policeman who then put on his uniform and went to work. So that was tragic, but it was a period where these tornadoes were happening over a number of days, and there was one in Georgia that went through a wildlife park and knocked out the fences, and a couple of tigers got away, but they were later captured. So you get strange things in tornadoes. I saw that the debris in one place got lifted up into the air, I think as high as 9 kilometres.
Wow.
Which is, you know, they can tell that on the radar, so they know for sure. And I know there was one I read about decades ago where I think, you know, a family photo that had the names of the people on it ended up about 200 kilometres away. So where it ended up, the people got in touch with the people from where it came. But But you get amazing stories with tornadoes. One of the ones that I remember was, I think, about 1926 in Alabama, a tornado shot and killed a man with his own gun. He'd foolishly had a loaded shotgun on the wall. And as the house disintegrated, the butt of the shotgun hit the ground and he happened to be in the path of the discharge. So we get occasionally tornadoes in New Zealand, but they're nothing like the strength of these American ones, thank goodness.
What causes them, Eric?
Well, in that part of the world, you've got very warm air coming off the ocean of the Gulf of Mexico, which has also got a very high water content, very high humidity. Now, it takes an awful lot of energy to turn liquid water into gas. And once that gas condenses to make cloud-lock droplets in the sky, it releases that energy. And that is a feedback mechanism whereby you can get incredibly strong vertical motions. They have measured, I think, 100 knots vertical speed in a tornado in America. And that's 180 kilometres an hour straight up, which is why they're incredibly dangerous for aircraft. They can rip a small aircraft to pieces. The bigger aircraft have radars in the nose so they can see these things and avoid flying into them. And the thing about that very strong upward motion is that as it's sucking air into it, if there's any rotation in the air, you end up with a situation a bit like watching water in a sink go down a plug hole once you've pulled the plug out. The water a long way from the plug hole is moving slowly, but as it gets closer to the plug hole, it goes faster and faster. And that causes the spin. And that can also mean that the pressure inside the spinning column is as much as 120, 140 hectopascals below the surrounding air. So you've got an incredibly big pressure gradient over sometimes just a few hundred metres.
Wow, I feel dizzy just listening to that description. But thank you. I've always been curious. I'm not going to be able to retell that to anyone, but I do feel much better informed about tornadoes than I was before asking. So I appreciate that, Eric. Now, methane release from the coal and oil industry. It's monitored by satellite. How does that work?
Oh, well, each different molecules have different interactions with the light coming past them, and so you can pick up the particular wavelength of light that's been through a methane molecule. So the satellite can identify where methane is coming from. This is a somewhat recent thing. It used to be that we relied on people promising not to let methane accidentally get released by an oil well or by a coal mine. But now that we've got these more sophisticated satellites, we can pinpoint these things. So what they found, I think it was August last year, there was one in Turkmenistan where I think it was releasing methane at the rate of 427 tonnes per hour, which is the equivalent of having 67 million cars with their engines running.
67 million, did you say?
Yes, 67 million. So it's a huge amount of methane. I forget how many days it went on for, but it did stop it after a while. But the trouble is a methane molecule traps 80 times more heat than a molecule of carbon dioxide. So that makes it incredibly effective in raising the temperature. The good news is that the methane molecule on average disappears from the atmosphere after 10 years because it's had a chemical interaction with other molecules in the atmosphere, whereas the carbon dioxide molecule on average lasts a bit over 100 years. So the opportunity is there if the oil and gas people can get on top of this, that we can make a really big difference to the sort of warming that's going on right now. One estimate I saw was if we can cut the methane that's accidentally being released by about 50% by, say, the year 2030, it'll save 0.3 degrees of global warming. And remember, we've got the current situation where the world is about 1.2 degrees above average. And to some people, sometimes that doesn't sound like a lot, but I like to make the point that global average temperature is a fairly conservative number. And the height of the last ice age, when there was so much water in the ice caps in both hemispheres, the sea level was 120 metres below where it is today. At the height of the last ice age, we only think the global average temperature was about 5 degrees colder than it is today. So the sort of threat of global average temperature going up by 2 or 3 degrees is truly horrific in terms of what it will do to the Antarctic ice sheets and the Greenland ice sheets and therefore sea level. There was a paper done by some of the people at Victoria University with others some years ago that said when the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was the same as it is today, which was 4 million years ago, was the last time that happened, sea level was between 10 and 20 metres above where it is today. Now, it will take several hundreds, even 1,000 years to reach that equilibrium, but nonetheless, we're at risk of setting and train something that would be absolutely devastating for human civilization.
Eric, I don't know what to say other than I'm grateful for the detail and for your delivery, and I look forward to the next time. But one last question I do have. Is there any weather anywhere in the world that's okay or that's better than okay?
Well, I think tomorrow in Wellington, apparently, according to the forecast. It depends what you want. I mean, there are places in the world where they get a lot of sunshine now because with the greater release of heat in the tropics, with thunderstorms in the tropics where it is warmer than it used to be, it means that the upward motion there, you get a lot of air spreading out at high altitudes and then sinking in what we call the mid-latitude anticyclones. So we're getting a lot of drier weather there. This is why you have the Sahara Desert, for example. And these anticyclones seem to be getting bigger and more persistent. But the downside, as we've talked about, is the Mediterranean, where they're getting droughts and wildfires, which extend also into countries like Iraq and Iran. And there has been a paper linking the increasing droughts in those areas to the beginning of the wars in Iraq and Iran and Syria. So there are, you know, political consequences from the droughts and the floods that we're seeing.
Eric Brenstam, thank you very much for your time tonight. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.